English teachers themselves share this frustration. I've been at Augustana College for 16 years, and I've taught freshman English for 16 years, and in 15 of those 16 years, we have completely changed the freshman writing text. Every May, we say there's got to be a better way of doing it. Something has to work. Something has to take. Nothing ever does. Nothing ever happens. And in fact, all of the studies that have been made on the teaching of freshman English at the college level indicate that it doesn't work, that it makes no difference whatsoever in the ability of students to write. A study at Ames, for instance, several years ago, Ames, Iowa, gave half the freshmen the traditional freshman English and released the other half of the entering freshman class from any kind of composition requirement, and then tested them throughout their 4 years, especially as seniors, and they discovered that there was no distinguishing difference, no variables whatsoever between the students who had to take composition and the students who didn't. Nothing in grades, nothing in their writing ability, nothing in what they did. So that apparently what we're engaged in the teaching of writing as English teachers is a totally futile task. So that if you're frustrated as parents, think of how frustrated we are in our fears that the dean may get a hold of studies like this and do away with freshman English. Many schools, in fact, have done away with freshman English simply because it hasn't seemed to do any good at all. What I'd like to do this morning is to suggest some of the problems that face Johnny as he enters school or as he enters our culture as a writer, and suggest that the problem is not really bad English teachers. The problem is not really Johnny himself, a new lazy generation that just won't wake up, etc., etc., but that some of the problems that face Johnny are problems that you and I as parents, as Americans, have created, and some of the problems are simply in the English language itself. And that Johnny has at least three strikes against him when he enters school to begin learning the process of writing. In the first place, there is a problem with the language itself. English is probably the most messed up language in the world. My wife had a classmate when she went to college, a college which will remain nameless except that it's in Northfield, Minnesota, who felt sorry for all the poor children born in France and Germany because they would have to grow up learning a foreign language. It was bad enough to have to do it at St. Olaf. But the irony, I think, is that English is the real foreign language, and that it is probably more difficult for a child growing up in our culture to learn our language than in almost any other language that you can think of. In the first place, let me just give you, I don't want to dwell too much on this because I think there are some more important problems facing Johnny, but let me give you an indication of some of the problems that Johnny faces as a beginning writer. If you know anything at all about the backgrounds of the English language, you'll know that originally it was Anglo-Saxon. The Anglo-Saxon invaders came over and decimated the Celts in about 500, and that for a time at least, the English language went on pretty much the way the German language went on. It was a heavily inflected language. It was related to German. In fact, the Angles and the Saxons had come over from Germany. But then in 1066, William the Conqueror in the Battle of Hastings brought French culture to England, and for a period of about 300 years, the dominant language, the official language of England, was French. French customs, French culture, and French ways. The only people who spoke English were the rural peasants and the middlemen, the merchants who had to deal with the nobility at the court and with the peasants outside. The result of that is that during that 200 years, the English language became exceedingly sloppy, exceedingly simplified, and when, in about 1250 or 1300, the English began to think of themselves as English again, and to reintroduce the English language and to try to do away with the French language, what happened was that the same thing happened that happens when you try to learn a foreign language. You mispronounce words, you get meanings wrong, and you completely botch the thing up, and you end up speaking a sort of combination German, English, French, or whatever it is you're speaking. And that's what happened to the English language. One serious result of that kind of sloppy treatment for 200 years and then a botched attempt to reintroduce English on the part of what was essentially a French-speaking culture was that pronunciations changed drastically. Anglo-Saxon word for stone was stanas, and that last syllable, the AS, was the inflected part. That is, it depended upon where it occurred in the sentence, whether it was stanas, stanum, stana, and so forth and so on. If you're familiar with German, you'll understand these inflected endings. By the time Chaucer starts to write in the middle 1300s, that last AS ending in most English words had simply become a kind of and it was spelled E. So that Chaucer spelled stone, S-T-O-N-E, but he pronounced it stana. Stanas is the Anglo-Saxon word stana. And by the time, because that last E was now meaningless, it didn't change depending upon where the noun occurred, by the time we get down to our period, the E is there because spelling doesn't tend to change, but we don't pronounce it at all. We simply say stone. The end result, then, is that English language, in most of its words, the spelling has no relationship to how we today pronounce the word. We do not say nicht. We say night. But, of course, the GHT is still there, and to Johnny, absolutely meaningless because it's not phonetic. Look at the one way in which we can take the same sounds and pronounce them differently. We say cough, rough, hiccup, and there are a whole series of words, O-U-G-H, rough, for instance, all of which are pronounced differently, but which are spelled exactly the same way. Johnny has problems then with spelling, partly simply because of the way the English language is structured. In addition to that, the English language is messed up because when we shifted from Norman French back to English again, the culture was far more sophisticated, and we began to adopt words from all over the place, from France, from Latin, from Germany, from literally every country in the world. And the end result of that is that today, although we have in the English language 300,000 words in our dictionary, different words, only 900 of those are genuinely English words. All the rest, with their varied meanings, come from every other country in the world, a fact which we're, of course, still doing, Sputnik, for instance, as a recent example. So that the English language has no coherence in its spelling and has no coherence, really, in its structure. We are really, literally, all the languages of the world put together, and that's something that Johnny really has trouble with without ever, I think, understanding why. One of the real miseries of the English language, however, and that makes it even more messed up than it might have been, is the fact that until the middle of the 18th century, we had no grammar at all. There were no courses in grammar and mechanics. Put the comma here, put the semicolon here, make this plural, spell it this way and spell it that way. English language just sort of grew like Topsy. But then in the middle of the 18th century, with the age of reason, with the coming of science, we decided that we had better be sophisticated. We had better adopt a grammar. What better grammar to adopt in the middle of the 18th century than Latin? And so we took the rules of Latin grammar and single-handedly, almost without any change at all, put those rules over on a language which was never meant to have it fit, which it didn't fit, and which it still doesn't fit at all. Let me just give you one small example. What is wrong? Maybe I shouldn't even ask if you think it's wrong, but what's wrong with the sentence, it's me. Can somebody tell me what's wrong with that? Or are you all... Yeah, what's wrong with that? Okay, why do you keep hedging yourself technically, or our grammar says? Don't you believe in our grammar? What? Okay, it is I is a Latin rule. The predicate nominative must be in the nominative case. I is the nominative case, and therefore one must say it is I when you're talking to an English teacher or probably anybody over now 80 or so. Okay, let me come back and pick on you since you're pickable onable. Why do you think it's true that that everybody says it's me then? When English teachers have drilled into you for literally hundreds of years that you should say it is I, why doesn't anybody say it? You what? No, finally the textbooks. The teachers, in fact, probably encourage. There are teachers who encourage that today. No, look, go ahead. What's wrong with I, and why do we just naturally avoid it? And I think most of us do. You don't hear Mary may say it is I or this is she, but... That's right, precisely, it's stiff. I ask my students, for instance, when and they all come saying it is I is correct and it is me is to be avoided horribly, and then they never use it is I. I asked him what would happen if a boy called up a girl at the dorm for a date and she answered the phone by saying, it is I, you know. Immediately they would know they should have made another phone call somewhere else. But if she says, hi, it's me, that communicates really what she wants to communicate, unless she doesn't want the date, right? Then she says, this is she or it is I. Precisely, it is I has always been stiff, it has always been artificial, it's me has always been what folks used, and the more our culture has become a folks culture, the more it's me is correct. And finally, as Barbara pointed out, textbooks have caught up with usage, and now most college textbooks, I think, say it is me is the preferred usage, and it is I is archaic. Most, that's right. most high school texts still say it is I in most situations, but maybe you can use it's me. But our freshman text, Mary, unfortunately says it's me, correct usage. It is I, stilted, archaic, outmoded. Okay, let me give you, yeah. Yeah, if you use it out, and you caught me using it's me and it is I, too. But more and more, I have been listening for it is I around, and I've never even heard, Mary, I've never even heard you use it is I. what we're finally doing, let me play the devil's advocate because I think I'm on your side, but what we're finally doing, the liberal grammarians say, is paying attention to what people actually say. Okay, why shouldn't usage be the determining factor rather than an outmoded Latin grammar that is 2,000 years out of date? No, should we still hold church services in Norwegian? Okay, it bothers Barbara and it bothers me too, and if I get time, I will explain why that to me a sad situation has come about. Let me give you one other example from the 18th century where our language really got messed up and which really has given Johnny incredible problems. What is wrong with "I haven't got no bananas," which Barbara's kids teacher would say perfectly all right. What's wrong with that? So what? Shakespeare used it and Chaucer used it. What's wrong with the double negative? See, if you walked into a store, Barbara, if you walked into a store and you'd say, "I want a pound of bananas," and the guy said, "I'm sorry, we haven't got no bananas," would you say, "Fine, I'll have a pound"? Would you ever mistake his meaning? No, you wouldn't. Where do two negatives make a positive? They do in mathematics. And what happened in the middle of the 18th century is that we decided we had better get scientific about our language. And if two negatives make a positive in math, by George, they make a positive anywhere. And out Shakespeare and Chaucer and everybody before the 18th century used the double negative for double emphasis. What the store clerk is trying to tell you is he really doesn't have no bananas at all. But, you see, out it went. A perfectly good double emphasis suddenly went out the window. Johnny uses the double negative because he's trying to emphasize something. But then he comes to school and suddenly it's wrong for no real reason whatsoever. It is wrong now if somebody, but it's socially wrong. If somebody uses it, you say, oh, what a clod he is for misusing the grammar. But there's a perfectly good need for the double negative, for double emphasis. And yet it's been destroyed by this artificial system that we've constructed around our language. The same thing is true with the word ain't, for which there's a need. There is no word for the contraction ain't, am not. Amn't, amn't is too hard to say. But you see, because in the 18th century there was no real equivalent for ain't, that is, it was a meaningless contraction, out it went, because it wasn't real, it didn't exist, it wasn't fact. And so English teachers started in on ain't, and they've killed it, I'm afraid, for at least 100 years. Nobody is ever going to go back to use ain't or the double negative, both of which there is good use for and a need for. Johnny then faces, when he comes to learn to write and to read, an incredibly messed up language, jazzed up by an artificial outside grammar which never fitted at all. And it's no wonder then that he's confused by the rules, by the spelling, and by the other things he's taught. There is, however, and let me quickly go on to two more things, and I will have time to do more than, although I'd like to maybe have a session on each of these later, let me mention both of these today because I think they are real problems facing Johnny. Language, for all of you who use it, you know how personal a thing it is. As a man speaks, so he is. Most of us, however gregarious and outgoing we might be, are private people and hate to reveal ourselves. And we know that as we speak and as we write, we reveal something about ourselves. People form impressions. We all have private spaces around us that we don't really like invaded except by invitation. That's why I think we're so disturbed, for instance, when speaking to people from Latin American countries for whom that private space is as close as 6 inches. You know, what's he doing? What's he trying to do when he gets up there close? Because for Lutherans, aside from Holden Village, that space is 3 feet, at least. Try getting closer than 3 feet to a Lutheran you don't know, and he starts edging back because he wants to keep that private space. At any rate, different cultures different cultures create different spaces, but everybody has that kind of space. Most of us, I think, teach Johnny to use language not to break the barriers of that space, but to help create the isolation of that space. I would suggest, I think, that most of us have taught our Johnnies not to communicate, but to not communicate. To use language as a barrier, not as a means of coming together. In many ways, we really don't want our Johnnies to express themselves honestly and openly. And unconsciously, by the time Johnny comes to a freshman English class at college, he has learned his lesson well. Let me give you some examples. My first assignment in a freshman English section has nothing to do with writing, but is designed to show how I think we create these spaces around us with language. I assign my freshmen, although they don't have to do it, and only about 25% have the courage to do it, I assign my freshmen to go up to somebody of the opposite sex whom they have not talked to, but whom they have admired from afar for his mind, his body, or whatever, and simply, openly compliment him. I like the way you dress. I really like the way you handle the orientation session or something. They cannot do it. They say, what will happen? What's he going to think? Or what's she going to think? And I say, well, at the very least, you're really going to make somebody's day happy. I know, but why can't, you know? And that is why Johnny has trouble writing, is that he has learned not to do that kind of communicating. I had two freshmen who, as an assignment, they were trying to discover whether Augustana College made people more open, more honest, and more communicative, more caring. Whether, in other words, as a liberal arts college, it was really worth the extra $2,000 a year in tuition that they were paying over Western Illinois. And they took a tape recorder and hid it in a book, and they went around campus, and they met people who would automatically say, hi, how are you? What does that little pointer mean? Hi, how are you? Does it mean you want to open conversation? No, it means you'd better answer fine, or everything gets all upset. And what these two freshmen did is they would go around campus and they would meet freshmen, sophomores, juniors, and seniors, and the freshman, sophomore, junior, senior would say, hi, how are you? And they would say, I'm terrible. I'm really in a quandary. I'm trying to decide, our family's trying to decide whether to put our grandmother in an old people's home or not. Did anybody, senior, junior, anybody, faculty member, ever say, let's go to the union, have a cup of coffee, and talk about it? You would be surprised at the tapes. No, you wouldn't, probably, right? At the tapes they got. Gee, that's too bad. Well, I got to go fix my car. people didn't know what to say. In other words, that little politeness, hi, how are you, is not a communicator. It's a non-communicator. It is designed to cut off communication, not to open communication. And I got to thinking last night, as I was kind of assembling this stuff, that the same thing happens, I suppose, when you get a particularly sensitive freshman who's having a personal problem, who turns in a theme in which he or she really spills his hearts out. What English teacher calls up the student and says, do you want to talk about it, or is there something I can do? No, we write all kinds of garbage on the theme about, oh, is this sensitive? This is, I understand what you mean, and so forth and so on. And we may give it a little higher grade because we feel sorry for the student. But do we as English teachers really want communication from our students? Do you as parents really want honest communication from your children? And in most cases in our culture, isn't the answer no? I was intrigued by what Larry Collins said the other night in talking about public prayer and about how hard it is to not hide behind language, behind the formality of an organized and efficient and smooth prayer, and really try to communicate through that prayer. Larry faces, I think, what all of us face, and certainly what Johnny faces by the time he gets to school. Children are honest, as any of you who have had small children or are familiar with them know, but by the time Johnny gets to school, he really has learned something I think that we cannot unteach him at all, and that is that few people really want to reach each other, and writing and speaking and even living has become a kind of game to be played. It is hard to get students to write honestly and openly because they have learned that you cannot do that and get along. You cannot respond with, "Hi, how are you?" with any kind of honesty, but only with, "Fine, thanks." You've heard that since 1963, and that's what's responsible for Barbara's dilemma over there on her children's grammar. Let me just get to that, and then I'll come back. What I'm doing is copying out because I don't know what. I mean, I read one textbook and it says let them express themselves, and another that says hogwash. You know, they need discipline, and both sound okay to me, and neither seem to work really well. At any rate, let me sum this section up. Part of the problem facing Johnny is that his language is himself, and he's really been taught that very few people in very few situations in our culture want him or want to hear what he has to say. We all hide behind cliches. To say busy as a bee or high as a kite or fluffy as a cloud is simply a way of not committing ourselves, of not letting somebody know what we really think. And we all spend our lives mostly not communicating with our language, but imprisoned by it. And that's something that Johnny, having learned no amount of English classes in college or high school or grade school, can really knock out of him. Let me end this is why it seems to me getting a C or an F on a piece of writing is so much worse. It is for me, and I think it is for most of you, is so much worse than getting an F on a chemistry or a math quiz. An F on a chemistry or math quiz simply means you didn't know the material. And you may be sad you didn't know the material and afraid of failing the course, but an F on a theme somehow really grinds deeper and hits harder. I think it does. And therefore, it becomes an extremely difficult thing to grade, because what you're saying about the person when you give him that F is not just that your writing is F, but you really are saying something about the person himself. So it's no wonder then that Johnny, facing grades like that, facing himself being graded, not just his writing, tries to hide, tries to give the teacher what the teacher wants, as he has learned to do mostly in our culture. I once had a colleague who, English teachers, one of the fringe benefits of teaching English is thinking of clever remarks to say about the students' themes and so forth. This was a football player who had written his fifth theme and for this colleague of mine. When he got it back, this comment was written upon it. "Congratulations, this is by far the best theme you've ever written, F." And it probably was an F theme. That is, the student had improved, but only so far within the F range. That, however, is real cruelty, I think, at the expense of another human being. As clever as that remark is, and as much as we might snicker at it, it's pretty shaky snickering, I think. Language is personal, and that's one of Johnny's problems. And then finally, and let me come down to just briefly go over the problem that really faces us as English teachers now. Language is also social. We only communicate, any two people or any people within a culture, We only communicate because we agree on something. Words have no relation to the thing they represent at all. Chair doesn't look or sound like chair at all. When we start disagreeing, or when a culture starts fragmenting, it's inevitable that the language with which we communicate also fragments. And that's part of the problem today, I think, is that our society not necessarily has lost its sense of values, but has adopted so many multiple values that communication between these little foreign groups, teenagers and parents, hippies and squares, all sorts of groups. We are not a culture anymore that uniformly agrees upon anything. There are two theories about this, and I'll briefly express those, about how best to make a human human, which is also how to teach him to write and express himself. The Greeks believed, and for a long time so did most English teachers, that what made a human being was the discipline and order and education of the state. The Greeks had very little compunction against leaving a baby that they didn't want out on the hillside to die, because the baby was not really a human being. It was merely an animal who had the potential of becoming a human being with nurture, with discipline, with training, with reason. And gradually, as a person grew up in the Greek state, he became a human. All of the other people without the advantage of Greek civilization became barbarians, merely animals who no longer even had the potential of becoming human. And I think for a long time, English was taught with this idea in mind, that there was a certain body of good literature, there was a certain way of writing well, and everybody had to be trained in that to become a young lady and a gentleman. And that meant not using the double negative. It meant putting the commas in the right place. It meant reading Silas Marner. It meant reading Macbeth, and what everybody in the country decided was the world's greatest literature, which accounts for the fact that in a recent poll, Silas Marner is, among American students, the most hated book in the English language. But at any rate, you see, we pounded it into them, we drummed it into them, and we said, this is how you had to do it. We could count on students coming from New York or Washington to school in Illinois. Everybody had read the same sort of thing. Everybody had the same backgrounds and culture. Everybody wrote pretty much in the same way, because our society was trying to make these humans human. We were trying to civilize them. We paid a price for that as English teachers. We became not so much enablers or teachers as policemen. It was the English teacher that you worried about not being wrong with. The price that English teachers pay for that, some of you have heard me talk about before, is that you don't dare admit to a stranger on a plane that you are an English teacher. Because he immediately will say, as some of you that I've talked to in the village have said, oh, I was terrible in English. Oh, I guess I better watch my English. The person clams up, he looks out the window, and communication is dropped. But if you tell the person, I'm an astronomer, does he say, oh, I don't know anything about the stars, I better... No. He said, I've often wondered how you know how far stars are. I have 100 questions. Or if the person's a psychologist, the answer, I don't know what the answer is, but I speculate that the answer is all sorts of questions about how the mind works. But does anybody ever ask an English teacher, I've often wondered where that comma went? No. They clam up, because we are the secret police. And therefore, the relationship between Johnny and his English teacher is very seldom a good one. It is one of the secret police versus the poor guy who's about to make an error, heaven help him, to think for himself, to write it his own way. What happened, Barbara, in answer to your complaints, is that in 1963, and I don't know why it happened then, in 58 we simply exaggerated this process of discipline and order with Sputnik, and we decided we'd better try to catch up with the Russians. And so students in sixth grade were reading King Lear and writing term papers and all kinds of just incredibly heavy stuff that I don't think ever really worked. But in 1963, almost overnight, and a student last year suggested maybe this was the assassination of Kennedy that suddenly woke us up to all sorts of other things. What happened in 1963 was this creative bit. Don't grade the student's papers. Let the student, a student isn't a human in the Greek sense because he has been disciplined by the state. It's the order and discipline of the state that have stultified him and left him just a shell of a human being. He's superficial. What you want to do is let the student say it his own way, express it himself. Don't give him a C on a paper. If he wants to put a comma someplace, that's his bag. Let him put it there. If he wants to say, we were going or we was going, so what? He has a right to say it his way. I have a right to say it my way. And who am I to correct him? Who am I to discipline and order him? Human beings will only become human beings if they flower outside law and order and discipline. In other words, a romantic notion took over. And that, I think, is where we are today, and one of the reasons why, Johnny, well, we are until this year. Schools across the country, again, almost overnight, are going back and tossing out what we did. Most of you are familiar with schools that instead of teaching the old traditional Macbeth and so forth, went to 40 different courses the student could take his own. Greek mythology, science fiction, fantasy, take any four courses he wanted. And the result is that there's no uniformity of culture, there's no uniformity of writing at all. We get freshman English texts now, which we have never used at Augustana, which have as assignments not what is truth or what is beauty in which the student struggles with an intellectual problem, but, and these are actual assignments, turn out the lights, burn incense, listen to music, and simply write whatever comes to mind. That's theme, okay? Another one is sit in a circle with a lemon on the desk and look at the lemon until you feel what it is to be a lemon, and then write a theme describing what it's like to be a lemon. Get outside yourself. Let the creative juices flow until they hit the lemon and then they go, argh. Here's my favorite assignment. Describe what it's like to lie naked in a bathtub of Jell-O. This is, I have the book with me. I will show you the assignment and the accompanying illustration along with it. Okay, now, the question really becomes, for English teachers, and I think for our culture, the question really becomes, which of these is right? Is a human only by ordering and disciplining and forcing him to say, it is I, and to be, if not correct, at least a society unified, or do you try to get rid of the rules? Let the person flower and blossom. Open out. Do his own thing. Don't make him feel bad about choppy sentences. Don't make him feel bad about lack of organizing. As one of our textbooks puts it, if his mind is choppy, why should he write smooth sentences? And really means it. And as funny as I'm making this sound, I hope, I am in a quandary, too, about which of the ways, the Greek or the Romantic, really make the better human being, or what incredible kind of combination do you need? And I think the problem is, Barbara, that most English teachers are in exactly the same situation. We don't know what works. We don't know whether we ought to rigorously impose law and order and discipline, or somehow let the beautiful soul within flow out, or how to do it, whether we should or not. Several years ago, before he retired, at the end of a very long career, we had a very wise Jesuit priest who taught English at Augustana part-time for a while before he retired to his monastery out east. And having taught all his life with a kind of rigorous Jesuit training, he had summed up all of freshman English and all freshman texts into two sentences. And that, for him, was the teaching of writing. Two things. See what's there, and two, tell the truth. But, of course, those are two of the most difficult things that Johnny could possibly face as he goes out into life. Because so many things, the language itself, the personal nature of language, and our crumbling and fragmenting society, all conspire against this
these two things, and they conspire against good writing itself. I should have left time for discussion, but and I will in previous sessions, but right now it's coffee time. I'll be glad to talk to any of you who console Barbara. No, I think things are shifting back, but I don't think it's going to work any more than it did before. I was blessed with going through a period in the early 50s or the late 40s when English became very practical. And so I didn't either write themes about lying naked in a bathtub of Jell-O, or did I write themes about truth and beauty. I wrote themes about, I learned to use the telephone and ask for a date. I learned to write a job interview. I learned to do all those kinds of things. So my own training has been pretty miserable. Yeah. You just play whatever you want, right? Okay. Oh, sure. I think this is not just a problem for English teachers, but for other people as well. But it is a real problem, I think, for me, because I haven't, you know, I do believe in the beautiful person within a, you know, I don't believe that much in law and order, but at the same time, you know, the law and order gets results. Some of you may have seen a survey done in a school in England earlier this year, in which they discovered that students trained in the traditional, most traditional method, rigid, absolute discipline, turned out to be not only better writers and better students in all their other disciplines, but also more creative and more because of the discipline than students trained to lie naked in a bathtub of Jell-O and express themselves. But, of course, the school that did the survey was a school that didn't offer the other kind of education. So I don't know what the survey means at all. What I really wanted to do today is leave time to ask some of you, you know, for my own personal interest as an English teacher, who have had good writing experiences, what made them good? I mean, what is there about that piano teacher? You may suggest, and maybe this is what I believe too, that it ultimately has to do with the person who's up in front of the classroom and not what the assignment is, what the method of teaching is, but there's something magic about your piano teacher that simply makes her a good piano teacher. Not me. I had to cheat in fifth grade to get by. Do you have a question? That's another thing that I go round and round about. We have a daughter now that's in a fun stage where she's still open and honest, and she says the weirdest things. A couple of you have heard these examples, but let me repeat them. Last year we were driving down to Holden. We came across Route 14 over from Sheridan, Wyoming, which is just an incredible switchback trail and so forth. And And Margaret and I were talking about, oh, what a twisty and turny road this is. All the cliches. I mean, we're caught in the language too. And Gretchen looks out the window and said, wow, what a scribbly road. You know, why didn't I think of that? You know, and so we immediately said, hey, Gretchen, that's great, and so forth. But now you see, Gretchen's at the point where everything clever she says, she expects a big response from. And instead of turning out a daughter who's open and honest and wants to communicate, we may be turning out a brat, right? Who just loves the little clever phrase because people will say, oh, hey, what, isn't that funny, Gretchen? Another time, the pastor's wife, when she was, I don't know, two or so, it was a Jonathan, excuse me. Gretchen went up to her and there was a big red fire truck or something and said, what color is that? And the pastor's wife said, red. And Gretchen said, very good. And, okay, but no. No, I don't at all, but I can see, you know, we would certainly like to encourage this kind of creativity and kind of openness that all children have and not destroy it, not say, oh, what a stupid thing. But how, see, my problem is, how do you keep that from turning into a precocious, you know, brat? I mean, I don't know. Yeah. The enthusiasm for without this kind of brattiness I don't know. Yeah. I don't know, I'd be interested in hearing from the psychologist in the back row there about how to... I think parents can do more than they think they can. I've talked to parents who feel discouraged because when they hit the school system, that creativity will be destroyed and they'll get it knocked out of them. I mean, we all say that somewhere about fifth or sixth grade, the boys start getting turned off about poetry. I don't think that's true. I think the home really, school doesn't take that much, I don't think. You're for brattiness.
Well, I think the error is often on the side of, you know, two of the right.
I think that's probably right. I guess what I'm not for is what, you know, Sherry talked about, making sure the kid waits till January. That is going by the book anyway. I think our three kids are so different from each other that I mean you have to see what's best for the kid. In other words, listen to him and maybe he'll write back.
Thank you.
Wait till January. Yeah, a lot just depends on, I guess, on the... Did you have a question? You raised... Yeah. Okay. A school has when he's one in the class of 40, has trouble doing that alone. And I think parents can really do a lot more than I see parents doing. Yeah. Don't people, including children, have a way of coming up to what you expect of them? I mean, I read a greatest story once that wasn't particularly great literature about somewhere in the Fiji Islands or something. A man picked out a very plain woman for a bride and then paid about 5 times the number of cows that she was worth and everything, which overhearing, she immediately became beautiful and loving and turned into a blossomed into a beautiful person. And I think there's really a lesson there for school systems too. Yeah. They quickly discover who's brownies and who's fairies and who's, you know, which row is the, however you try to disguise level 1, level 2, and level 3. Word really gets passed down, I think, from teachers in grade school. Just wait till you get so-and-so, you know. Well, let's go have coffee, okay?